The second point is that Canada took on a, and was, had up until the moment of the earthquake, had taken on a leading role in training the Haitian National Police Force. You know, so it's supposed to be training this National Police Force to, you know, secure the country and so on. But it did this in the context of a MINUSTAH mission, which was widely criticized by Haitians, by human rights organizations, for using the cover of this UN mission to, in fact, carry out extrajudicial killings and to undermine the popular base of the most popular party in the country, which was the Lavalas party, which was led by the president who had been removed from the country. So it was fundamentally anti-democratic, because in the minds of the Canadian, U.S., and French governments, the Aristide government was constructed as some kind of terrorist, possibly potentially communist. I mean, who knows what they imagined. But they could not, they refused to accept, you know, this is the most popular, and this is a democratic, you know, party. It's a democratic party. He's a democratically elected president, because Aristide's policies did not accord with the kind of vision for Haiti that these countries had. And we can talk more about that in the question and answer period. But basically, this was a coup against a democratically elected leader, and then a UN stabilization force, which legitimated that coup, which was designed to undermine the party that he had led into power in the first place. So Canada was training the Haitian National Police in this context, and this is in a period where, and there are numerous studies, the best one of them, which appeared in The Lancet, the medical journal The Lancet, in September of 2006, which clearly said that the Haitian National Police was, in fact, the most dangerous military force in the country. It was responsible per capita for a significant number of unsolved murders. It was they were accused of a significant number of unsolved murders in the period between 2004 up until the time that this study was completed in 2006. And there have been eyewitness reports since then, including since the earthquake, that has not changed. This is the force that the Canadian government is training. And this is in a context of what most Haitians feel is effectively a military occupation by the UN that is a cover for the interests of specific countries. And in the context of this also, the Canadian government was responsible for funneling large amounts of aid to effectively bogus aid organizations in the run-up to the coup against Aristide. And, you know, these are sort of made them publicize themselves as democratic organizations, but they were effectively political organizations which were opposed to Aristide. So Canada does not have a history of some kind of disinterested aid, like apolitical or politically uninterested or nonpartisan aid. It has always had this profoundly partisan relationship with the Haitian landscape, and it has taken on a really devastating role in supporting anti-democratic politics. So all of this, again, you know, to sort of sum up, you know, I think we really need to rethink, you know, what our government is doing, you know, in the Caribbean generally, but and in Haiti in particular. And I think part of the reason why the Canadian government gets away with this and people are not critical of it, when I say these things, people say, well, she must be, you know, some kind of crazy leftist. You know, it's like, The Lancet agrees with me. I don't think you could call The Lancet crazy leftists, right? But, you know, there's a sense that somehow our government is more responsible to us than to other people, you know, and it can do, in what it does in other places, even if these things are not, you know, things that we might like done to us, it's not as responsible for those things as it is for the policies that it pursues here. And for those reasons, you know, what the Canadian government does in Haiti is treated as distant, is treated as, you know, far away, and so on. But, you know, I mean, in very profound ways, those policies do come back to haunt us, and we do need to recognize that in many ways, what the Canadian government is doing in Haiti is effectively the export of our corruption elsewhere. It's a corrupt policy. You know, this government is no less corrupt in terms of its relationship to the Caribbean and to Haiti than it accuses the Haitian government of being. There's an intimate relationship between the perceived corruption or ineptitude, whatever you want to call it, of the Haitian government and its relationship with equally corrupt governments in the West. It is corruption, this relationship. And as Canadians, we need to think about, you know, I think we need to get used to thinking of ourselves as, you know, living under a government that effectively exports its corruption elsewhere. So that's where I think, you know, to come back to the original point, some are poor because others are not. This perception of, you know, sort of our sort of clean and relatively pristine political space. Well, that is maintained because effectively so much of that is foisted onto other people. And that's a responsibility we need to recognize as our own to deal with. This is not a Haitian problem specifically, or not only. It's a Canadian one as well.
Thank you, Dr. Melanie Newton. And now for Dr. Manuel Rosenthal.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Melanie, for that. I won't dwell on anything that has been said, but I will say clearly that I agree with everything, especially the final statement. And I will begin by telling you this. 2 days ago, I was at a meeting similar to this at the Andina University in Quito, Ecuador. Catherine Walsh, Juan Garcia, and other three people were talking about Haiti at a different format there. And I'll tell you something interesting. Two of the speakers spoke of the poetry, the creativity, the artists, the music of Haiti. And in fact, that was extraordinary, and it was essential, because it actually brought an image to my mind that, as you were speaking, came back to me. A Latin American artist and poet and so on wrote a very famous poem about why the colors of the poncho from the Andes, why are they so colorful, given that the mountains are rocky and life is so dull and sad? And his answer was essentially, that's why. And the joy of Haitians should become contagious. And if we achieve what should be, the avalanche, l'avalas, should extend from Haiti throughout the continent, as it's meant to be since the day they became the first free country of this continent and an example to everybody. So I think that's where we should begin. And then I'm going to pose a question to you, and it's the impossible to answer in Canada, I'm convinced. And that's the challenge for Canadians. What should it be instead of what it is? I mean, I don't see many Canadians asking themselves that question, because the assumption is what it is the way it is. Therefore, Haiti won't be free as long as people keep thinking that way. What it is shouldn't be, shouldn't have been, should not continue to be, has to change. And it has to change here. So the assumption to begin with that Canada is right and helping and that everything is okay here and maybe there are some problems but we're an example is quite the opposite. Every single little bit of well-being there's in Canada is at the expense of others, and it's not the only place where that happens, but it certainly happens here, even though the assumption is Canada is an example of democracy, freedom, and peace. So I'll make that fairly strong statement. I was asked to provoke for the conversation. There you have an initial provocation. So I'm going to give you, I don't know if you've had the chance to look at this note by Bill Quigley that was published in Z Space of ZNet with some data. And then I'll give you other pieces of data and contrast this and then present my main points. 890 million is the amount of international debt that Haiti owes creditors. Finance ministers from developing countries announced they will forgive 290 million. And you already know what the debt from France is equivalent to today. So just an image of aid. 644 million are the donations for Haiti to private organizations. Over 200 million have gone to the Red Cross that had 15 people working on health projects in Haiti before the earthquake. But 40 million has gone to Partners in Health, which had 5,000 people working on health in Haiti. And the source is not a communist manifesto, but the New York Times. And they haven't mentioned the Cubans, of course, which I will mention later. 1 million people are still homeless. 1 million people who have been given food by the UN World Food Programme in Port-au-Prince, but there's still another million who haven't received any. 300,000 people injured in the earthquake. By the way, President Preval announced this morning that they have buried, the government of Haiti has buried 170,000 people in mass graves. This morning, this was announced. Now, one should ask for a minute of silence. Not appropriate. It's the opposite. No more silence regarding Haiti. Then the other numbers, there are close to 20,000 U.S. troops. 17,000 down from a high of 22,000 U.S. troops in Haiti. There were already 9,000 United Nations troops in Haiti. And one more number. There are 4,000 amputations performed in Haiti. Every physician involved in disaster care will tell you that one amputation is a sign of a failure. 4,000 amputations mean that they arrived late, they did the wrong thing, and they can't feel proud of that at all. Now, I'll give you another bit of information. This comes from a communist, Carlos Alberto García Domínguez, the head of the Cuban medical mission in Haiti. And last Friday he stated, "We have been here since 1998, since Hurricane George arrived." I'm going to ask what Canada has been doing since 98 there, but I leave that to you. The second thing is they've looked after 34,500 patients since the earthquake took place. They've performed 1,297 surgeries of high complexity. They don't include amputations because the amputations they've had to do are 380 of upper limbs and 640 of lower limbs. And they have 800 people, medical people, in 18 teams. They're running 3 hospitals in Port-au-Prince. They have 10 health centers throughout the country. And the most important statement he made, I think, is we are not advertising this and we're not going away. When the fashion goes away, we will be here with the Haitians. Now, is this propaganda for Cuba? Take it as you wish. But I'm, in the context of our presentation, I'm comparing this to what Canada has done. And I leave that question with the facts laid on the table. I'm not going to go through any of the history of Haiti, which should be known, but I simply mentioned one of the many books that have been written, as I found it fantastic. Well-informed and extraordinary, a must-read for anyone who's interested in that country, is Damming the Flood by Peter Hogarth. It's an extraordinary book. I still hear people saying, from the right, that Aristide is to be blamed for everything that's wrong, as well as Lavalas, even now, during the consequence of the earthquake. And from the left, is Aristide used to be a good guy, but then when the Americans... Clinton invaded the first time and he came back, he had already given in to the Americas. Well then, if that was the case, why was he kicked out again? Through a military invasion. So I leave that question on to you as well, and then a shameful, probably the most shameful bit of Canadian history in this continent so far is Haiti. And Melanie was referring to it, which is, I think, extremely important. But it involves not only the government of Canada, worse still, many and most of the NGOs, the Canadian International Development Agency, and particularly many of the human rights progressive Canadian organizations who played a key role in attacking Lavalas and in attacking Aristide. Why? A question they'll have to answer, but there's a lot of documentation on this. And many can say that if it wasn't for these progressive agencies and this kind of solidarity, maybe, and their accusations against Aristide for human rights violations and thievery, maybe Haiti would have resisted with its first democratic government. Because the paradox is, it was the first free country for black people in this continent and for everybody, because the U.S. had 500,000 slaves when Haiti had them free already. But it was the youngest democracy achieving a democratic elected regime in 1991 only, their first elected regime. And that was tolerated. That was no disaster that called for international aid throughout the centuries. So I have to acknowledge something else here. Everybody talks about Venezuela being the first one of the pink revolutions, of the progressive revolutions in Latin America and in the Americas of recent time. democratic revolutions. It was not. It was Haiti. Le Petit L'Église, Aristide, once again, they show the path to freedom. And I think Aristide is right when he says, even if they take me out, no matter what happens to Haiti, they will not stop on their path to freedom because it's in their hearts already. So my conviction is that as well. They have decided to remove themselves from a humiliating misery into a dignified poverty. And it's not Aristide who says that anymore. It's in the heart of Haitians. Who else in this planet would be hungry, without home, with relatives dead or disappeared, under the horrendously horrible sun of Haiti, no food, no water, surrounded by militaries from the US who do not deliver the water and stop the agencies of aid from delivering food and water to them? Who else would not try to steal the food and the water only to, so that order can be brought back through the use of military force, which is a way by which the invader creates a pretext for racism and military occupation? And that is what is happening on the ground, report after report after report. But I'll give you another image so that you can contrast with this. I think you've seen Canadian newspapers, but I've seen many American newspapers, particularly the Miami Herald, showing the cute-looking black children of Haiti being flown all over the world so they can have a new opportunity. Wide open thievery of children that is acclaimed as humanitarian aid without any reaction anywhere. Now, my question is to Canadians, you have to be racist to accept these images and not jump at them in anger. What if at your home, a white home, an earthquake came in and then black people from Africa came to take your children to give them a new life? Would you accept it for a second? So I'm challenging hegemony, and hegemony is a state of mind, an acceptance of what is, as though it has to remain in the same way. And that horrendous hegemony exists here, not only in the government of Canada. And that's what I wonder if it can be changed. So let's put the facts on the table. At least 200,000 people dead. The U.S. Occupies the country with 20,000 soldiers. Canada announced 800. If you calculate the proportion of Canadian population to U.S. population, that is a significant number. And MINUSTAH was there already with Canadian forces before, and what was mentioned here before already. So Canada has occupied Haiti militarily as well. That's a fact as well. The other fact that has been documented, although covered up as well, is that the military have not provided aid. They have become a hindrance to the logistics and the delivery of aid. And if they have, there was an intention behind this. Everybody that still supports Obama's decision to send troops argue we had to put order there first, and the army is there to help. Well, I'll quote the former foreign affairs minister of Ecuador two nights ago in an interview, who said, you have to be part of the aggression to accept that argument, because there is multilateralism, there is UN. So even if you were to send troops, you can't send them on your own because you're the biggest empire around. You have to discuss it with others. There was no discussion. In fact, I think Raul Sivecki, the fantastic researcher and Latin American activist and writer on social movements, said it right at La Jornada last Friday. Haiti has become another ship of the fourth fleet of the U.S. in the Caribbean. So what have they achieved? Two facts. One, the largest U.S. military based in the Caribbean is Haiti today. What did they use as a pretext to achieve that? The sadness, the injuries, the destruction of the country, and the racist history behind it. There is another base in the Caribbean. They had a pretext. They used it. Whether or not the alleged Russian fleet presentation of that this was provoked by the U.S. or not, I won't even get to that argument. I mention it because it's been around. But the fact is it was a pretext for another base in Central America. And I'm going to go through, get beyond Haiti to try and locate Canada within this context. The first thing is we can't forget we are the system, the economic system of free trade. The neoliberal system is in its deepest structural crisis. That cannot be forgotten, otherwise we won't understand Haiti. And we have to remember very briefly that there are three modes of accumulation that capital has used. The accumulation of surplus value by the exploitation of labor, and that's a long history in Haiti. The second mechanism is accumulation by dispossession, which is the typical model of the neoliberal agenda, and that's David Harvey, who presented most of the arguments there. And then there's a third one that everybody denies. It's accumulation by destruction. When you have excess capital, when you have the resources of the planet that are becoming scarce, you could do one of two things. One is the obvious, recognize the system is a failure and it's damaging because there's too much for too few and too little for the most, and stop killing it, which is not in the dictionary. And the other thing is you destroy the excess of people and capital, without which you could get a few consumers to buy a lot and accumulate again without trouble. Now, it's not my explanation, but many look at the First and the Second World War as having achieved precisely that. H1N1, wars all over the place, even climate change will generate massive displacements, disasters such as those in Haiti, and provide the excuse for massive occupations. And who cares if many people die? You can actually use those dying to mobilize more aid and move the economy. But your intention is not that. So I have to put that in place. The second thing I have to put in place is the fact that the global architecture today of economic power cannot start with nation states, not even the US. Everybody knows, or at least should know today, that the transnational corporate and financial institutions are at the head of the global governance system. And it is them who make decisions. Or didn't you watch Dick Cheney go in the revolving door to government, back to Halliburton, back to the government, or Condoleezza Rice to Chevron and back to the government? I mean, that's the revolving door everywhere. And these corporations are dictating the free trade model, which is based on two things. You exploit people as cheap and free labor, and you exploit nature for the resources that are required. Within that map, you locate Haiti and what's going on now, and it's something that is called La Gran Alianza. Canada, U.S., Mexico, Costa Rica, now Honduras, another U.S. coup, which Canada jumped immediately to recognize even before the U.S. acknowledged that there was a coup, even when Obama was saying that it was wrong that the coup took place there. Canadian foreign minister was already recognizing the transient government. Then keep going. Panama, Colombia, Peru, Chile recently, and you have what is called the Great Alliance. Now let's look at this in military terms. Haiti, right next to Cuba with 20,000 troops, very close from Venezuela, and Nicaragua, whom they don't like. Panama, 4 military bases accepted by the government now, completely surrounded. That's a military base. Colombia, at least 6 bases, a government totally under the control of the U.S., and with 450,000 men and women in arms, twice as many as Brazil has. A very good friend of Canada today, and Canada is promoting this government, a free trade agreement with Colombia, and Peru. Filled with bases. What we have now is, if we look back, and here's the difference between today and the past. As a child, I used to think, how did it happen in Germany? I can't imagine that they start invading other countries and destroying people and putting them into concentration camps and killing them. What went on? And I used to look at it with fear, but with my imagination. Now, you have U.S. troops with Canadian support for economic purposes, already invaded Haiti, Honduras, Panama, Colombia, and have the fourth fleet going around. And Canada has joined in. And you have the Canadian mining interest from Cabañas, I see it in your T-shirt, to the southern tip of the continent, involved in transforming the mining codes of the entire continent to deliver legally the mining resources to transnational Canadian capital. But you also have the use of force, paramilitary death squads, and illegal crimes, together with army invasions of territories and displacement of people for mining resources. So people in Haiti used to produce rice to eat. They also made baseballs only at the cheapest price and garment for a Montreal-based company. The only thing that did not fall in Haiti were the maquila factories where the Haitians are exploited. And there's no more rice in Haiti because they were forced to produce sugarcane, palm oil, and other products for your cars in Canada. Those are some of the questions I'd like to leave with you. Thank you.